Hello and welcome to Eerie Earth. I'm your host, Kieran. Thank you for joining. Tonight I will be telling you a dark tale from deep inside the heart of Scotland's capital, Edinburgh. In our journey through this eerie earth, we have visited Edinburgh a couple of times, and now we return as I tell you the dark, gruesome tale of the haunting of One-Armed Johnny. Allow me, if you will, to take you back to Edinburgh in March 1689. The city is overcrowded, with upwards of 50,000 people living behind the ominous Flodden Wall, protecting people from the suspected horrors that dwell outside of the city. Buildings stretch high into the sky, towering over the populace, blocking out the sun from the closes and the lanes that snake from the high street. Human waste and muck falls from the sky as it's thrown from the windows, with a distant bellow of Gardy Loo being heard on the wind. The streets are littered with muck, dirt and rubbish. The residents walking, trying to stay upright and not slip on the wet, foul-smelling mud. Our story begins with a man called John Cheesley. He was a landowner coming from a small hamlet outside of the city known as Durley. He lived with his wife, Margaret Nicholson, and together they had 11 children. John had a tendency to fly into rages very quickly and would often do this to his wife and his children. He eventually had enough and did the one thing he could think of to get rid of his family: divorce. He filed for divorce from his wife, but for the common person, divorce was not awarded easily. It was only reserved for the incredibly wealthy and sometimes royalty. The man who proceeded over the divorce was a judge called Sir George Lockhart. He was seen as a fair man, and when John came to court to file for divorce, at first he refused, stating that just because he'd fallen out of love with his wife, he had a responsibility over his 11 children. He got himself into the mess, and he had to get himself out. John flew into a white-hot rage and started screaming at the judge in the middle of the courtroom. Anger bubbling, the judge kept refusing until he decided that he had enough of John and finally agreed to the divorce. But because of the way he was acting, he ordered John to give his wife and his family 150 merks, the currency at the time, a month to ensure that his family was looked after. That's around £8,000 in today's money. John's anger and rage did not subside, and he ordered the judge to change his mind, but he refused. John pointed at the judge as fire burned behind his eyes, and he screamed that he would not let the judge get away with it, and that he would kill the judge. George Lockhart waved it off and thought, "Whatever, I hear it all the time," and thought nothing of it. A few weeks passed, and George Lockhart had been receiving ominous anonymous letters which stated that he was going to die, to sleep with one eye open, and to always watch his back. At first he just dismissed them, as just an annoyed person had been judged, but when the letters got more frequent, George went to the authorities and told them about the letters. They advised him to try and ignore them, and that because there had been no actual threat upon his life, they couldn't do anything. He tried his best to put it out of his mind and move on, which he was able to do so. Easter Sunday 1689 rolled around, and he decided to attend an Easter service at St. Giles. At first he was apprehensive about being in a big crowd, an attack could come from anywhere, but the service went without incident. Happy with how it went, he made his way home. His house was at the bottom of Bank Close, a tight, dark street cut off from the high street by a gate. He opened the gate with a creak and pulled it shut behind him, ensuring to hear the click of the gate, and made his way down the close, the same thing he had done every day. As he started down the stairs of the close, he heard the gate open. He looked behind him to see who it was, but could only see shadows lurking behind him. The dull glow from the flickering candle and the lantern on the street fought against the darkness but was losing. He carried on, but could hear hurried footsteps following him. He turned again to be greeted with the seemingly darker shadows. He began to quicken his pace, and pulling his collar up around his neck, reaching for the front door. The door had a large rusting lock hanging from the chain which snaked around the handle. He fumbled for his pocket for a large key that opened the sanctuary of his home, and as he pulled it out, he watched his handkerchief float to the ground. He reached down to get it, when bang! A gunshot filled the close, echoing up the tenement houses and out into the Royal Mile. Pain coursed through the back of George Lockhart as he fell to his knees, his back soaked in crimson. He turned around to see John Cheesley standing over him, brandishing a still-smoking gun. John held the gun aloft, allowing everyone who gazed down from the windows of the houses and from the entrance of the close to see the gun he used to kill the judge. He then bellowed at the top of his lungs, "I have killed the judge. I have taught him justice." And then he started laughing maniacally. Police officers filled the close and threw him against the wall, throwing a pair of manacles around his wrist, marched him off out of the close into the awaiting police carriage, and took him down to the Canongate tollbooth, and threw him in a small, damp, mouldy jail cell. He spent one night in the cell before being taken to court. He was placed upon the stand at the courthouse wearing filthy, smelly rags, and his arms and legs were bound in chains. The judge peered over him in small spectacles and with a tight-lipped mouth told John that he had committed a heinous crime. He was forced to face the jury as they made their judgment. The jury concluded very quickly that he was guilty, mainly because he had admitted it and was seen standing over the victim still wielding the gun. He then turned to face the judge, who leant over his desk and peered down at the cowering man and told him, "You are sentenced to be hanged by the neck until you are dead. However, prior to your execution, you will spend some time in our dungeons where you will be tortured for your disgusting, heinous killing of a man, a friend, and a colleague who did no wrong." Without protest, John was led from the courthouse into a carriage and taken back to the tollbooth. However, this time, he was taken down some uneven stone steps into a cobbled stone room. A large wooden table sat in front of him, with leather straps hanging down. The table was stained with dark pools of crimson, and he was led to the table where he was tossed upon it. His arms were bound by the leather straps, and a device called thumb screws were applied to both of his thumbs. These were three bits of wood with a screw on the top. The thumbs went in the middle and the screw was tightened. As it tightened, the wood lowering and slowly started to crush the fingernails on the thumbs. John gritted his teeth, feeling the pain course through his hand. Further and further, the torture twisted the screws and John could feel the wood start to crush the small bones. The further the screw went, soon the thumbs turned red, purple, then exploded, sending blood spraying all over the cobblestone as John let out a deep guttural scream, trying to remain as calm as possible. The torturer left John on the table, blood still dripping from the remnants of his thumbs as he pulled some leather strips out of a bucket, dripping with stale, dirty water, the bucket stained with a thick, disgusting brown paste dripping onto the floor. As John was writhing on the table in pain, the torturer started to wrap the leather strips around his bare legs, the water still dripping onto the floor. The relatively warm water was dripping down his skin onto the floor. The torturer, when happy with the placement of the strips, moved a small metal trolley underneath John's legs. Hot coals were sizzling beneath his skin as the water dripped onto the burning stones. The heat was unbearable, as John could feel his skin slowly starting to burn and sizzle. He could feel the leather strips known as booties slowly start to dry and constrict, and as they dried, they cut into the skin of his legs, blood slowly starting to seep out and drip onto the coals. The tighter the leather strips got, John could feel his bones slowly start to strain under the tightness of the strips, crack, and then eventually break. As John could feel and hear the sound of the cracking bones, a deep pain screamed bellow from within him. The torturer was not finished. He looked with a twisted smile upon his face, twisted in a maniacal look as he watched over John's laboured breath move his chest up and down, sweat covering his entire body. The light from the lanterns on the wall illuminated the room enough for the torturer and the tortured to see what was happening. The torturer walked over to the corner of the room and reached for a small hand axe that was hanging loosely upon the wall. He grabbed the handle and brought it over to John, the blade glistening in the dull light. He grabbed John's right arm and stretched it out over the edge of the table. John was weak by this point, and barely up to a fight, and with a swift swing from the axe, it chopped through the skin, muscle, and bone, removing the arm entirely. The discarded appendage fell upon the ground with a slosh as blood gushed from the wound onto the filthy floor below. John's abuser grabbed the metal poker from the dying embers of the fire and carried it over, the tip glowing red, and inserted it into the newly opened wound of the arm, cauterizing the wound. John was returned to his cell, his beaten and broken body left lifeless on the disgusting feces-covered ground of the jail, where he lay until the first beams of sunlight pierced the darkness the next morning. His cell door opened, and he was roughly lifted out and dragged into a cart that was waiting outside of the Canongate tollbooth. The sun had now reached its peak, and the streets were full of people going about their business, selling wares, going to jobs, or just hanging out in the street, watching as the cart trundled past along on the cobbles of the high street towards the Market Cross. When it reached its destination, John's broken form was tossed from the cart onto the ground, dragged by chains that were wrapped around his body, and he was led to the gallows. Thousands of people had gathered around the Market Cross to watch his execution, screaming profanities and anger-laced screams at him, whilst others threw stone, mud and fruit at his broken body as it struggled to stand with broken legs. He was being held up by a skinnier man wearing dirty, torn rags as the hangman put the noose around John's neck and pulled it tight. As John watched out over the crowd, the sun beating down on him, the sounds of the city disappeared and were replaced by his beating of his heart. When suddenly, the sound of the trapdoor opened, filling his head, and he fell, his neck breaking instantly. John's body was taken from the gallows and placed inside a gibbet, a metal cage that hung from a wooden beam, as a warning to anyone who may try to do the same thing that he did. His body was meant to be left in the cage for months, to slowly rot, and his bones would be left to the crows. However, after 2 days, his body disappeared. At the time, no one knew what happened to John or where his body went to, but they had their suspicions. It was thought that his brothers-in-law came to collect the body and take it back to Darley, where he would be buried. Authorities didn't much care. As long as John Cheesley was dead, that's all that mattered. The following week, the residents of Edinburgh began to report strange happenings around the High Street. People would report as they made their way back to their homes and various tenement houses along the Royal Mile, a dark shadow would claw its way along the close, pulling itself along with one arm. The horrifying shadow would send the witnesses bolting from the close in terror. Others would report icy cold hands upon their back, slowly pushing them down the stairs of the close, resulting in a broken ankle or broken leg. Some would exclaim they saw a zombified figure with one arm and broken leg shuffle its way towards them up the dark, gloomy close. So frequent were these sightings that mothers and fathers would start creating stories to tell their children to keep them in line. "If you don't eat your vegetables, one-armed Johnny will come and get you." He began to become a bit of a boogeyman. These reports went right up until 1965, when they were converting Darley House, the home where John Cheesley resided, into flats. They did some work in the basement of the building and discovered underneath one of the paving slabs a skeleton with a broken neck, one arm, and two broken legs. They removed the skeleton and buried it in a grave in a local cemetery, and all reports of the haunting in the city stopped. But in the flats, people were still reporting strange activity. Some would report hearing disembodied voices and cries, and witnessing dark shadows standing at the edge of their beds. The tale of John Cheesley and the murder of Sir George Lockhart is one that has been told time and time again. And with every single rendition, there's always something extra or something is forgotten. But you never know. If you come to visit Edinburgh and you make your way along one of the many winding closes and lanes of Old Town Edinburgh, you just might encounter an icy cold hand helping you along and one-armed Johnny may very well be one of the culprits. Thank you very much for listening to this haunting tale of One-Armed Johnny. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to support Eerie Earth and any of its future endeavours, I have a Patreon where for just £3 a month, you can get a personalised shout out in every future episode of Eerie Earth and any upcoming audio dramas. If you would like to follow Eerie Earth, you can find me on Facebook at Eerie Earth, Instagram at Eerie Earth Official, YouTube at Eerie Earth Official, and TikTok at Eerie Earth Official. Or why not visit my website at eerieearth.com. You can find Eerie Earth anywhere you get your podcasts, and I would love it if you could follow me on Spotify. Again, thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye for now.